Welcome back to this third installment of Ordinary People, Extraordinary Things, a view of how God brings about revival. We've been looking at the Great Awakening, and it's rather astounding, isn't it, when you look at the effects that we saw in the last lecture, the incredible things that happened, the number of people joining the church, the amazing things that happened. In fact, one of the people I want to introduce you today is John Greenleaf Whittier. He was a Quaker poet. And he wrote a poem that was intended to glorify or at least make known the ministry of George Whitefield. And it goes like this. So the flood of emotion deep and strong troubled the land as it swept along, but left a result of holier lives, tenderer mothers and worthier wives. The husband and father whose children fled and sad wife wept as his drunken tread frightened peace from his roof tree's shade and a rock of offense his hearthstone made. In a strength that was not his own began to rise from the brutes to the plane of man. Old friends embraced, long held apart by evil counsel and pride of heart, and penitent saw through misty tears on the bough of hope on its cloud of fears. The promise of heaven's eternal years, the peace of God for worlds annoyed, beauty for ashes and oil of joy, all celebrating what happened in what we've called the Great Awakening. It was a time of religious ferment, a time of growth in the church, a time of impact socially, and yet in the 1740s and 1750s, the spiritual tide began to turn, and it turned down, not up. And so now we're going to look today at why in the world that happened. Apathy toward religion returned, and the reasons for that change are very complex, but there are two of them in particular that we need to look at. And those two have to do with what we're going to see as the pattern over and over. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Quote from the book of Judges, which defines a great deal of the history of the United States in spirituality. A new generation comes up. They don't adhere to the same principles of revival and evangelism the way the previous one does. And why? Why was there a decline this time? Well, there are many things that contributed to it, but the two big ones are the Enlightenment and economy. Now, in order to understand the Enlightenment, there are some people you have to get to know a little bit. Copernicus, in 1543, wrote The Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres. He was somebody who observed, as probably the first true astronomer, he observed the movement of the sun, of other stars and planets, and he came to the conclusion that the Earth was not the center of the universe. Now, back then, they had a very simple view of how the universe was constructed. There was Earth. Above the Earth was what was known as the heavenlies, and below the Earth was what was called hell. And so we lived on this plane, and the Earth was the center. The universe kind of functioned outside of that plane up in the heavenlies, but now Copernicus was saying in his The Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres that the Earth is not the center of the universe. Rather, the sun is just one among many stars, and that the Earth is a planet around those stars. Now, Copernicus knew as he wrote The Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres that his views were not going to be well received, particularly by the church. At this time in history, the Roman Catholic Church in the 1500s had a huge control over the life in Europe. And so he did not put his name on this. He published it anonymously and only claimed on his deathbed to be the author, although many people suspected he was prior to that time. And so you have Copernicus saying, wait a minute, the view that the church is espousing is not accurate. The Earth is not the center of the universe. Now, his teaching was picked up by Galileo. He posited in 1613 a piece that he published called Letters on Sunspots. He posited again, built on Copernicus, that the Earth is not the center of the universe. And in fact, the Earth is just one small planet. Now, he was able to do that because up until Galileo, the strongest telescope had a power of 6. In other words, it brought things 6 times closer than just natural eyesight. Galileo worked and worked on developing a telescope that eventually was 30 power, could bring things 30 times closer. Now, if you have a pair of binoculars, they're probably at least 30 power. But in his day, it was revolutionary. And So he began to teach as a result of that. No, the earth is not the center. And for that reason, he expected not just persecution, but he expected maybe even to be excommunicated. In 1616, 3 years after the publishing of Letters on Sunspots, the Pope forbade him to teach what he had written about. He agreed to stop teaching, but then in 1632 he began it once again at the encouragement of other scientists, and he was tried for heresy, and he was sentenced to spend time in house arrest, and he spent most of the rest of his life that way. And so you have to be aware of Galileo as part of what we call the Enlightenment. The third person who was part of that is Isaac Newton. 1686, he published the Principia Mathematica. Now, every school child, I think, in the United States knows the story of the discovering of gravity, that Isaac Newton was sitting under an apple tree and an apple fell on his head, and therefore he began to ponder why the apple would fall down, and he posited that it was gravity, and that's how he became people who believed in gravity. Well, that story is not quite true, by the way. He did notice things falling, and he gave credit to some observations like that as the source of his study. But the landmark part of this study is the laws of motion. Because as he looked at the planets, again, building on Copernicus, building on Galileo, he posited that things were done in the universe in a very orderly way, a predictable way. Now, we can't quite imagine how different that was for that time. You see, up until that time, the turning of the earth and the movement of day to night and of the different seasons as the earth wound around the sun. Of course, they didn't believe that at that point. They thought the sun was revolving around the earth. All of that they believed prior to this as God's action. It was God who did it. It's God who brings the new day. It's God who causes the seasons to occur. It's God who brings the storms. And now there's this idea that everything is built to be incredibly organized, incredibly rational. And these things today are the foundation of education. But back then, they were just absolutely incredibly revolutionary, so much so that the church felt threatened. Now, the results of the Enlightenment are simply these. God was no longer seen as the cause of everything that was going on. And the church, because it continued to embrace that belief and focus on that as the reason for everything happening, was beginning to be seen as old-fashioned. And then the next guy who becomes very important is John Locke. John Locke was one who applied these ideas of everything happening in an orderly way, in a systematic way, began to apply them to social problems, and said if we could only figure out the principles, then we would be able to solve all these social problems that are being faced in the world today. So the Christian church was threatened. In fact, there were even some who questioned whether Christianity would survive. Voltaire was a French philosopher who lived during the period of the Second Great Awakening, 1789 to 1815. He predicted that Christianity would die away in the next 30 years. Francis Scott Latourette, an eminent Christian historian, said of this time, prior to the Second Great Awakening, it looked as though Christianity were a waning influence, about to be ushered out of the affairs of men. Sidney Alstrom, a historian, summarizes the effect of John Locke on his day. He more nearly personifies the reigning spirit of the 18th century than any other thinker. His thought is guided by three great optimistic principles: that the chief end of man is felicity, or happiness, in this world and probably in the next; that man's rational powers, if rightly disciplined and employed, provide a means for solving the problems of life and attaining this felicity; and that the essential truths of such a view are so self-evident, and man himself so responsive to such evidence, that progress in human felicity is inevitable. In other words, just to interpret, the next step in life has to be happiness, and if we would just describe or just apply our rational capability to that, we become more happy. It's normal, it's natural, it's an orderly world that we live in. And so these are the kind of thoughts that were part of the ferment of what was known as the Enlightenment. It's a powerful name for a period of time because an enlightenment implies that people were living in darkness before this, but now these new ideas have brought light on the world. And so that's what was going on. And that's what the Enlightenment represented, that the church was seen as part of the darkness, not as part of the light. Now, how did the Enlightenment come to America? Through these two men. Primarily on the right, you'll see Thomas Jefferson. On the left, John Adams. Two of the early presidents in this country, certainly formative as authors of a Constitution and a Declaration of Independence. Now, we have this belief in America, at least many of us in the evangelical world, that the United States was founded on Christian principles, and we keep saying we've got to go back to those Christian principles. But the reality is, both of these men spent considerable time in Europe, were well acquainted with Copernicus, Galileo, Isaac Newton, John Locke, and were impacted by their beliefs. In fact, Thomas Jefferson at one point decided to create what is known as the Jefferson Bible. It still exists. It's in a museum in Washington. He decided that if you just look at the world from a rational point of view, you have to take out everything supernatural. So if you take out everything supernatural, you've got to get rid of all kinds of things in the New Testament. You have to get rid of miracles, first of all, because they don't happen. You have to get rid of some of the teachings of Jesus that imply that he was a supernatural person because such a thing doesn't exist, because everything is done in a very orderly fashion. There isn't a God who intervenes in the world in any significant way. And so he made his Bible by taking a penknife and cutting out all the areas that referred to anything supernatural. And as a result, it's a very, very short Bible, a very, very short New Testament. John Adams, one of the principal authors of the Constitution of the United States, as a result, these two men were known as deists. In other words, they believed there was a God. They believed that he was the first cause and that he was somebody who created the world. But then he just kind of set it in motion, following the laws, the normal laws of what we see happening in the universe today and what is demonstrated scientifically. Now, that had an impact on the church. What would be the church's reaction? Now, the church being threatened caused it to react in one of three ways. One, they could accommodate or ignore or compromise. There were some who decided to just ignore the whole thing, and they decided to go their own way. And they didn't work a great deal at trying to understand science. In fact, they began to advocate an idea that science is kind of the enemy of Christianity. There were those who compromised. You'll find that in some of the churches of that time, very much in the Presbyterian and Anglican traditions, in that they tried to find value in the science that had been discovered, but they wanted to hold to the old truths as well. And then there were those religionists that decided that accommodation is the key. And on the east coast of the United States, the Universalist Church became a very common thing. Here are the summaries of what the Universalist Church believed. There was an emphasis on mankind's freedom to choose for the good and his natural inclination toward goodness. See, there was this belief that man is just getting better and better. The Christian faith was proclaimed as simple, and the complex theologies of the Reformation and even the medieval church were ridiculed. John Locke boiled genuine, enlightened Christianity down to two rules: believe in Jesus and lead a life of virtue. Living a moral life was considered the ultimate goal of Christianity, and therefore things like sacraments were considered to be a superstition. The idea of progress was effective. Our progress was prominent. In other words, mankind would gradually improve until the kingdom of God was ushered in naturally as the result of very normal forces, the way God had created it originally. And then God was seen as a power or first principle. He's often referred to as a deity. And the enlightened man was having a hard time trying to find a connection with God as a personal God. Now, you can go in the eastern part of this United States and other places that sprung up, but you'll find the Unitarian Universalist Church, and that's what came out of this period of history. And it's a fascinating thing. I was privileged to live in the Boston area for 6 months in 1991 as I worked on the background for what was going to become the book that is the foundation for this class. And as part of that experience, I decided to take my children to a Unitarian Universalist church one Sunday morning. And in fact, it was on April 1. So we were going to church on April Fool's Day. And so we entered the church, and there was a string quartet playing glorious classical music. And the service began, and it was a real mixture of people. But there was no sense of really what's going to happen here. We all gathered in. They had a kind of museum in the opening part as you enter the entryway. And in that museum was a Bible under a glass case. And that's kind of where the Bible they thought should stay. And we went through the service. And the message that day was, don't be an April Fool. And talked about, you know, how to be somebody who was good and wise and who made a positive contribution to life. And I remember afterwards, we came out of the service. We had taken the bus there in the Boston area. And so I've got three kids. At that time, they were 6th grade, 5th grade, and 2nd grade. And so on the way to a restaurant to eat lunch after our Sunday worship experience, I asked these children, so what do you think? What do you think? And very perceptive. At that time, they were becoming spiritually more alive themselves. But my son said, I don't understand why somebody gets up on Sunday morning to go to that. Just don't understand it. And I guess that was my reaction as well. If you don't believe that there is a God who intervenes in our life today, why would you get up to worship? Why would you pray? What would life look like? These three very common responses became the characteristics of the church prior to the Great Awakening. Second thing that happened was the economy. The economy in that time after the Revolutionary War was devastated. And poverty was very, very common. Alcoholism was widespread. Depression, unemployment, you know, all the stuff we saw in our recent Great Recession here in the United States. In fact, J. Edwin Orr, a historian known for revivals, described this period of time this way. Of a population of 5 million, the United States suffered 300,000 drunkards and buried about 15,000 of them annually. Christian chroniclers complain that for the first time in history of the country, there was a surfeit or a widespread experience of lawlessness, a profusion of gamblers, of gangs of robbers and slave stealers. Drunkenness was common and profanity prevalent, they said. Immorality had increased as standards of honesty and morality declined. The effects was particularly seen in a variety of ways. There was decline in membership, so much so that it was estimated that only about 10% of the church retained an active church membership during this period before the Second Great Awakening. Immoral life was considered norm. College students, Lyman Beecher, who was a preacher at that time, said college was in a most ungodly state. The college church was almost extinct. Most of the students were skeptical and rowdies were plenty. Wine and liquors were kept in many rooms. Intemperance, profanity, gambling, and licentiousness were common. So as I said, there are those who thought that Christianity was about to end. But the question we have to ask each time is this one: how would God respond? The church has taken this dip, began with talking about judges, about generation growing up that wouldn't know God, and they forgot him. How would God respond? In the history of the United States, we're going to see that once again, as we see the height, the spiritual height of the Great Awakening, and now we see the trough going down within just a couple of generations, we're going to see how God responds with a second Great Awakening that in some cases outpaced the First Awakening by leaps and bounds. And so that's the subject of the next lecture.